Clive Owen, and good evening to you all. This Bristol Radical History Week has been a great idea, and Roger and his team have done fantastically well to bring us all together around some key things around the history of Bristol. And it offered me an opportunity to crystallise some thoughts that I've been had knocking around in my mind, you know, for quite some years. I used to be an historian. I'm not an historian any longer, and I haven't practiced as an historian this century, certainly, and probably for 10 or 12 years. But as I said, this event, the series of events, offered me an opportunity to get back into that historical way of thinking and to think about some things that I thought were quite important. And as I said, crystallise them and boil them down into something that might be interesting to an audience such as yourselves. So I have to start what I'm going to say with an apology, because I completely failed to take advantage of that opportunity. The idea was, when Roger finally persuaded me, I think in June or July, to take part in this event, that it would give me time to do some serious reading and to make some notes and to look at some evidence for the sorts of thoughts I have, and then I'd be able to come here with something, you know, really quite useful and substantial. Actually, I haven't had time to do that, so what I'm going to try and entertain you with is just the sort of thoughts that I've been having about the history of Bristol and its relationship with slavery and with the sugar and tobacco trades. And I'll tell you the sort of things I was going to say if I'd done the work properly, if you understand what I mean. I have noticed a couple of you taking notes, and, you know, it's one of those times you said, please don't write this down. I am sort of making it up as I go along, but I think there's a kernel of truth there that really I'll be happy with if some of you go away thinking about. And perhaps there'll be somebody here with the time and the interest to develop some of these ideas if they're worth developing. So with that sort of proviso, and apologies to the proper historians here, who've actually done the work and do proper research, and I'll plow on. So the things I wanted to talk about, tobacco and sugar, and in the abstract Roger asked me to provide, I described those as the drugs of capitalism. And I was going to talk about the relationship of Bristol's Atlantic trade with growing industrialisation, the Industrial Revolution, and nutrition and malnutrition in the industrial proletariat of England in the late 18th and early 19th century, most of the 19th century probably. And I'm sort of prompted to think about these things by, I love Bristol. I'm from Bristol, I grew up in Bristol, and I've moved around the country and I've travelled a little bit outside of the country, and I do think Bristol is the most staggeringly beautiful city I've ever seen. And part of that is the geography and the topology and the hills, but there's also some absolutely fantastic architecture in Bristol and some gorgeous urban vistas. When you look down across the top of the hills and look down across the city of Bristol from any number of angles and in all sorts of different light, and there's the water and the docks. And I do just think Bristol is a glorious, glorious city to walk around and to live in and to see and to be in. But where does that come from? Where does this... And I mean, you may not agree with me about the beauty of Bristol. I'm going to take that as a given. I'm afraid that Bristol is beautiful. And it's what it's founded on. Where does that glorious urban architecture and urban environment come from? And in thinking about that, it comes down to three of the most evil things that have ever been perpetrated, I believe. It comes down to the horrendous trade in human beings, the triangular trade and the slavery wing of that. And I believe it's also founded upon the import into Britain of two of the most disgraceful things that have ever been imported, which is tobacco and sugar. And actually all this beauty of Bristol is founded upon a nightmare, a horrendous nightmare. All the money, all the wealth that built the Wills building that houses our university is tobacco money. And so it's thinking about those things and what is the impact of that trade on life and lives in Great Britain, and how does that fit in, because clearly in terms of when these things were happening and what happened alongside them, there are strong links between the trade that Bristol was a focus of, a nexus of, a locus of, and industrialization and the development of industrial capitalism, which again, you know, I was always a Marxist and I was an historian. I always thought capital always agreed with Jean-Bertrand Aristide from Haiti, who said that capitalism is a mortal sin. So, some interesting bits and pieces I have picked up in the little bit of reading I've been able to do. In the late 18th and 19th century, England was the largest consumer of sugar anywhere in the world. And that consumption of sugar really does coincide with the growth of industrial towns in England. The history we're taught is about improvements in agriculture, freeing up labour, which migrates into the towns and gets involved in industry, and you get the great industrial revolution, and Britain's a world leader in industry and manufacture and the application of technology to production. The story really is the uprooting of people from their traditional peasant lifestyles, from their subsistence lifestyles, from growing their own. They're being forced off the land by the capitalization of land and agriculture, and they're being forced into the pandemonium of early industrial England. Huge cities sprang up in half a century, maybe 1780 to 1830, maybe a good 50 years to think about in terms of the growth of Birmingham, the growth of Manchester, the growth of Leeds and Sheffield, for instance. Did agriculture really improve, and the story is that agriculture improved and that the rationalisation of agriculture improved, did it really improve to such a degree that you could take a quarter, a third of the agricultural workforce out of agriculture and stick them into industry and still feed them with wholesome food? And there really is no way to imagine that that was possible, and it's impossible to do it now. You know, we rely on food from all over the world to feed ourselves now, and we have relied on food imports since at least the middle of the 18th century, if not before. And so what food is being imported? Well, there's some grain being imported from the emerging United States and from Eastern Europe. But there's a huge, huge trade in sugar. The three largest components of the industrial working class diet are bread, potatoes and sugar. At times of low wages, wages fluctuate massively during the Industrial Revolution, and if you're trying to scratch a living in Manchester and you're at the bottom of the heap, you're a factory operative, the house you live in doesn't have any facilities for cooking. And so you're relying on the food you can buy. At times of low wages, so when cotton is scarce, the cotton trade gets interrupted and there are vicissitudes in that. The consumption of both bread and potatoes can be seen to fall, but the consumption of sugar remains constant. So sugar is the amongst the three largest food items. And if you look at the nutritional value of sugar, you find that the nutritional value of sugar is absolutely zero. It provides you with energy. It enables you to work that machine. It enables you to get to work, and it enables you to carry on working. It doesn't feed you. Sugar doesn't feed anybody. It's quite a nice additive to add to nourishing food to make it taste nice. But as a foodstuff in itself, it's absolutely worthless except in giving you empty energy. And the Industrial Revolution, early industrialization and middle industrialization and the development of those industrial towns is fueled by sugar. And where's that sugar coming from? Well, a large number of the West Indian islands were monocultures in the early 19th century. They produced nothing but sugar. And they produced that sugar by exploiting slave labour from Africa. So the whole sugar trade is intimately tied up with slavery, and is intimately tied up with the development of industrial society in England. Eric Williams, an historian from the West Indies, has written about this as far ago as 1944, and his thesis has been variously challenged, and you can look in the detail of what he says and what people have said about him. But England was the largest consumer of sugar throughout the 19th century, and the large bulk of that sugar was imported from the West Indies, and it fueled the Industrial Revolution, and it did nothing at all in terms of nutrition for those workers who were eating it. They were eating raw sugar and buying big lumps of raw sugar and using pliers and tools to tear hunks off and eat them. If you had a little bit of money as an industrial worker, you could afford to buy jam, which would have a small amount of fruit in it, and was produced on an industrial scale, and sugar is an industrial commodity, and it's processed on an industrial scale. And if you go to Manchester now, you can still see the Robertson's Jam Factory, and it's still got a mockery cartoon of a black person on the front of it. That's the jam jar thing. And think about where the sugar came from to go in that jam. And think about how hateful that symbol is. And that's still there now. Sugar doesn't really appease your appetite. Sugar gives you energy to keep you going. And in terms of the industrial workforce, I believe that's where tobacco comes in. Because tobacco is well known as an appetite suppressant. Very well known as an appetite suppressant. One of the big problems with, apparently, with keeping young women off of tobacco in this day and age is because all the supermodels who need to stay thin, they all smoke, so they don't get hungry. And the people that were importing tobacco were also the people who had to victual the ships that sailed back and forth across the Atlantic. And it can't have taken long for ship's masters and ship's chandlers and the capitalist entrepreneurs who were financing those voyages to figure out that if they had sailors who smoked or sailors who chewed tobacco or sailors who took snuff, they didn't need to put so much food on the boat. But they didn't need to eat so much. It also wouldn't have taken them long to figure out, and I think one or two voyages to figure out, that if your crew was addicted to tobacco, and the tobacco ran out before you got all the way home, you'd have a bit of a nightmare on your hands when those people went into withdrawal. And anyone who smoked and tried to give it up will know that tobacco withdrawal is a serious withdrawal, and anybody who smokes will know that tobacco addiction is a serious addiction. So tobacco's got a role to play, I believe, in fueling the Industrial Revolution. It suppresses the appetite of those workers who actually haven't got access to proper foods. The food they've got access to is heavily adulterated, and remember, it took until the 1830s and 1840s for a cooperative movement to develop, which prevented people being restricted in where they could buy their food to their employer. Most people's food prior to the establishment of the cooperative movement was sold to them as part of their wages by their employer, and they would give them a big hunk of sugar and some horrible bread and some potatoes. Tobacco is also the perfect capitalist drug if you look at it from a Marxist perspective, but I tend to look at things in terms of exploitation and alienation. It's not really that expensive, and you can market it at a price that your workers can afford. And once they've been using tobacco for a week or two, they will struggle to give it up, and they will remain your customer for your tobacco for as long as they stay alive. And tobacco is one of those really useful drugs, if you want to make money out of it, that doesn't kill anybody with an overdose. It kills people 40, 50 years after they start smoking it, just before they're due to collect their pension, if you want to be really cynical about why smoking isn't banned, even now in the 21st century. So, I mean, that's it really. Those are the sorts of thoughts I've had kicking around in my head as I admire the city of my birth and its beauty, and think about what that city is founded on and what that's meant in terms of the industrial development of the United Kingdom. And the fact that there was malnutrition in the 19th century in Britain on a large scale, affecting millions of people. Something that hadn't really been seen in England since, I would say, 1380. Malnutrition came back, and it wasn't about there not being enough to eat, it was about being the only things that you could eat were rubbish, and in particular sugar. So that's it, folks. Thank you very much for your patience. Roger asked me if I'd be happy to take questions. Of course I'm happy to take questions. I'm just not sure I'm going to be able to answer them in any real sense, but I'll have a go.